This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Today we have something special, an interview with Bruce Springsteen that I recorded a few days ago at his home studio in New Jersey, not far from where he grew up. His new memoir shares the title of his most famous song, Born to Run. The theme of that anthem is escape, but in much of the book, Springsteen reflects on how he and his music were shaped by home, roots, blood, community, freedom, and responsibility. Throughout the book, you sense the presence of Springsteen's father, from whom Springsteen says he learned the rigidity and blue-collar narcissism of manhood 50s style, and the distorted idea that the beautiful things in your life, the love itself you struggle to win, will turn and possess you, robbing you of your imagined, long-fought-for freedoms. He says his father resented his own family for what he thought he might have accomplished, but didn't. Springsteen also has a new CD called Chapter and Verse that serves as an audio companion to the book with a selection of songs that span his career. Let's start with a track from the album that helps set the tone for our conversation. It's his demo recording of his song, Growing Up.
Okay, take two.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade. I combed my hair till it was just right and commanded the night brigade. I was open to pain and crossed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch. Well, I strode all along to a fallout zone and came out with my soul untouched. I hid in the clouded wrath of the crowd. They said, sit down. I stood up. The flag of piracy flew from my mask.
Bruce Springsteen, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you for welcoming us into your studio. I'd love it if you would start by reading the very opening from the foreword of your book. It's really a fantastic book, and I'd like our listeners to just hear a little bit of your writing.
Okay, my pleasure. I come from a boardwalk town where almost everything is tinged with a bit of fraud. So am I. By 20, no race car driving rebel. I was a guitar player on the streets of Asbury Park, and already a member in good standing amongst those who lie in service of the truth, artists with a small a. But I held four clean aces. I had youth, almost a decade of hardcore bar band experience, a good group of homegrown musicians who were attuned to my performance style, and a story to tell. This book is both a continuation of that story and a search into its origins. I've taken as my parameters the events in my life I believe shaped that story and my performance work. One of the questions I'm asked over and over again by fans on the street is, how do you do it? In the following pages, I'll try to shed a little light on how, and more importantly, why.
Thanks for reading that. So many of your songs, particularly the early ones, are about, you know, like searching for a dream and wanting to like bust out of the confines of your life. And in some ways, I get the impression from your book that that was your father's story, except he never found the dream. It's kind of like a little bit like the story that you describe in your song, The River.
Right. My dad was young. We went to work. But he'd been to war. He'd seen some of the world. It wasn't like he was going to be an extensive traveler or something. It didn't seem to be in the nature of his parents or many of the folks in my family. Really, we had a cousin that went off to Brown University. It was like a nuclear explosion took place. It was just incredible for everybody. So you're correct. My parents did really sort of live out a big part of that story. And to a certain degree, he did find his little piece of what he was looking for in California.
Because when you were 19, he moved to California.
Yeah, they moved out west, which was a huge undertaking because it was like moving to another planet for them. But I think that's what my father wanted to do. He wanted to move to another planet. They had very little. They had $3,000, and they I think they had an old Rambler, and they slept two nights in the car and a night in a motel, and they had my little sister with them with all their stuff packed on top. It was a really go-for-broke decision, and it did pay off for them. You know, I think they enjoyed the West Coast and their California life quite a bit. You know, my father still had periods of illness that were...
mental illness?
Yeah, difficult to manage. But I believe he did feel like he found something there that he couldn't have found at home.
Do you think the song Born to Run is in part about him and in part about you?
Well, someone mentioned that to me the other day. I always thought it was just about me. But what do you know? And looking back on it, my parents lived out quite a bit of that story themselves.
Except you had a dream in a way that your father maybe didn't have a dream that he could articulate.
It certainly wasn't one he could articulate. It was just, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And
You write, too, about your father that he was kind of very, let me quote you because you put it so well. You write that he loved me, but he couldn't stand me. He felt we competed for my mother's affections. We did. He also saw in me too much of his real self. Inside, beyond his rage, he harbored a gentleness, timidity, shyness, and a dreamy insecurity. These were things I wore on the outside, and the reflection of these qualities in his boy repelled him. I was soft, and he hated soft. Of course, he'd been brought up soft, a mama's boy, just like me. So that timidity and shyness that you wore on the outside, it's kind of like the opposite of your stage persona.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the timidity and shyness of your youth?
T. Byrne Burnett once said that much of rock music is simply someone going, "Wow, daddy." So I've got to take some blame for that myself, I guess. But it was when I was young, you know, I was very shy and that was my personality. You know, I was a pretty sensitive kid and, quite neurotic, filled with a lot of anxiety, which all would have been very familiar to my pop, you know, except it was a part of himself he was trying to reject, so I got caught in the middle of it, I think.
Do you know, like you say in the book, that you were so nervous for a while during your childhood that you blinked like 100 times a minute?
Yeah.
And you chewed your knuckles. Was there a specific cause of that anxiety, or is it just... Do you think the way
never
you were wired?
I mean, I never found out. You know, it was just tremendous anxiety. You know, tremendous feeling of being out of control of your young life.
So, do you think that your stage persona draws both from like the angry and uninhibited side of you and the more inhibited, timid side of you?
I think it's both there. I think if you just, you know, I think I've had plenty of folks, if you just looked at the outside, it can read, you know, it's pretty alpha male, you know, which is a little ironic because, you know, that was personally never exactly really me. I think I created my particular stage persona out of my dad's life, and perhaps I even built it to suit him to some degree. When I was looking for a voice to mix with my voice, I put on my father's work clothes, as I say in the book, and I went to work. Whether it was a result of wanting to emulate him so I felt closer, or whether it was I wanted to be the reasonable voice of revenge for what I'd seen his life come to. It was all of these things, and it was an unusual creation. But most people's stage personas are created out of the flotsam and jetsam of their internal geography, and they're trying to create something that solves a series of very complex problems inside of them or in their history. And I think when I, unknowingly, when I went to do that, that's what I was trying to integrate all of these very difficult things that I'd been unable to integrate in my life and in my life with my parents.
So when your father told the family that he had to leave New Jersey and go to California, and he was going to do it, he hoped the family came with him, but he was going to go one way or another.
Yeah.
And so he left, your mother went with him, your youngest sister went with him, your sister, who was in the middle, was 17, she had just gotten pregnant. You say she didn't even know how to make toast. And your parents left.
I may be a little harsh on her there. I think she knew how to make toast.
And you were 19. And suddenly, suddenly there were no authority figures in your life. I mean, your parents were gone. Your father wasn't going to, whatever he was doing, he wasn't going to do it anymore. He wasn't going to be around. What did that freedom feel like to you?
Well, by the time I was 19, my parents weren't very authoritative over my life.
You were already gone.
Yeah, at the time, I was already down at the shore, and mm-hmm. I was staying out overnight and sleeping on the beach and, coming home at 3, 4 a.m. after having played a show or in some club. I was 5 years into my own life already. It started when I was 14 and a half. And I didn't have any doubt about that at that time about what I was going to do or where I was going. I was a musician. I was going to play. I had a band. We were going to make enough money to survive on. I was quite prepared for that to occur, whereas my sister was in a very different situation. She just had a newborn and a new marriage and really missed the family when they left.
During your early years as a musician, you were in Asbury Park, Boardwalk, Carnival atmosphere. What did you love about that kind of urban beach?
Yeah.
And the, Madame Marie and all of the Boardwalk regulars. You made great stories out of those characters, mm-hmm. great songs out of those characters. But what appealed to you about knowing them and writing about them?
It was just my location at the time. I didn't move to Asbury with the thought of, it wasn't an anthropological
but you connected in some
reason,
way.
But I went and I just fit in there. Asbury was down on its luck, but not as bad as it would get. And so there was a lot of room to move. Clubs were open till 5 a.m. There were gay clubs. And even in the late 60s, it was a bit of an open city. So as young ne'er-do-wells, we fit very, we fit very comfortably in that picture. And then when I went to write, I just wrote about what was around me. It fired my imagination. It was, of course, a colorful locale. The city was filled with characters and plenty of people at loose ends. And so it just became a very natural thing to write about. I didn't give it too much thought at the time, but I did think that it gave me a very individual identity, and that if I was going to go out into the musical world on a national level, I was very interested in being connected to my home state. There wasn't anyone else writing in this way about these things at that time. So it was something I did very intentionally, in a sense, as creating a certain very, very specific and original identity.
I want to quote you again. So you write, this is toward the beginning of your career. I wanted to be a voice that reflected experience and the world I live in. So I knew in 1972 that to do this, I would need to write very well and more individually than I had ever written before. And this was, at some point you realized too that although you had like the most popular bar band in Asbury Park, mm-hmm. that there was a bigger world, there was a lot of talented people. And in order to be someone in that world, to have a career, to make a difference, that you had to figure out what was unique about you, and you had to write great songs. And in fact, you achieved that. You wrote great songs, but you know, how did you go about trying to write the best songs that you could? I mean, when you knew that a lot of this was going to depend on the songwriting.
When I thought about signing a record deal or writing something that might put me in the position, because I'd already had plenty of things that had fallen through with my rock bands, I looked at myself and I just said, well, you know, I can sing, but I'm not the greatest singer in the world. I can play guitar very well, but I'm not the greatest guitar player in the world. What excites me about a lot of the artists I love? And I realized, well, they created their own personal world that I could enter into through their music and through their songwriting. There's people that can do it instrumentally, like Jimi Hendrix or Edge of U2 or Pete Townsend. I didn't have as unique a purely musical signature. I was a creature of a lot of different influences. And so I said, well, if I'm going to project an individuality, it's going to have to be in my writing. And at the time, for one of the few times in my life, I didn't have a band. I just had myself and the guitar. So I was going to have to do something with just my voice, just the guitar, and just my songs that was going to move someone enough to give me a shot. So I wrote songs that were very lyrically alive and lyrically dense, and they were unique, but it really came out of the motivation to, where I understood I was going to have to make my mark that way.
You've lived your life, a lot of your life on the road, and for a lot of your early years, I mean, you were single, you were in monogamous or semi-monogamous relationships, as you describe it, but you weren't married, you didn't have children. You had a first marriage, and then Patti Sciolfa joined the band, and you got married, and you have three children now.
Yes.
What did it take for you to see family as something that was a wonderful thing as opposed to something that was going to harm your sense of freedom and flexibility and creativity?
I think for a lot of musicians, that's a difficult call because by nature, we're transient. We move on. We're people that, like I say in the book, there's folks that stay and there's folks that go, and we're folks that go. I didn't have a blueprint from my childhood that I could call on, which is an enormous deficit when you're trying to put together a family life. I didn't see a family life where men were thriving inside of it. You know, my dad tended to blame family for his inability to achieve what he wanted to achieve, you know. So, unfortunately, I was coming from that particular frame of mind, and it took quite a bit of work and time and mistakes to begin to feel, to understand the strength and that comes along with building a home life, you know. That was very mysterious to me. I was very skeptical of it for a long time and didn't understand it fully until Patti and I got together.
You write about redefining what it meant to you to be a man, that you'd learned about the rigidity and the blue-collar narcissism of manhood, 50 style, from your father, and you learned to always withhold something. You do not lower your mask. Did you consciously rethink what it meant to be a man?
These are hard questions. Fresh air is difficult. All right, let me think. Well, you know, you're young and you're always in pursuit of your young manhood. You know, you're trying to figure out, what does that mean? What is, you know, there's a lot of pressure on young men to sort that out. And, you know, we tend to gravitate towards one-dimensional iconography as far as what it means to be a fully grown man, and you can get lost in so much of it out there. But, you know, part of my on-stage creation was someone trying to sort that out. I think initially our audience were filled with young men. You know, our initial audience was was a lot of young guys who I think were trying to, who you played a bit of a big brother role for, and were trying to sort out a lot of the same things right soon as Born to Run hit, you know. So it was something that I worked pretty hard on.
You started going to therapy in 1983. And at some point, you say in your 60s, you had a really bad depression. And I'm wondering if you thought about, during that period when you were very depressed, how many people in the world really wanted to be you? And
doesn't count for that much at the time.
Yeah, right.
You know, but of course, you know, people see you on stage and, yeah, I'd want to be that guy. I want to be that guy myself very often. You know, I get I have plenty of days where I go, man, I wish I could be that guy. And, you know, it's not quite, there's a big difference between what you see on stage and then my general daily, my daily existence.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm talking to myself.
Oh, okay.
Don't let that bother you. It's part of my illness. I do it all the time.
you're right about how being on stage is almost like medicine for you. You know,
sure.
Does it get you out of yourself? Does it?
Oh, of course. You're immediately pulled out of the inside of your head, and it immediately changes your frame of mind. I've never been on stage where I've. No, that's not true. I have been on stage on a few occasions where I felt I couldn't escape the interior of my interior thoughts. But Peter Wolf once said, "What's the strangest thing you can do on stage? Think about what you're doing." There's just nothing weirder you can do. If you're up there thinking about what you're doing, you're just not there, and it's not going to happen. You know, so trying to learn how to overcome those. Which is a normal thing to do. You're in front of a lot of people. People are going to get very self-conscious. So you have to learn to sort of overcome that tendency towards self-consciousness and just blow it wide open, and you jump in and join all those people that are out there enjoying what you're doing together.
During the Depression, there was a period of a year and a half when you weren't on the road. You were home with one of your sons, I guess with your youngest.
Mm-hmm.
Did that contribute to the depression because you couldn't be on stage and you couldn't have that kind of cathartic experience?
Yeah, I tend to be not my own best company. I can get a little lost if I don't have my work to occasionally focus me. But at the same time, you've got to be able to figure that out. The year and a half I was home, my son was in his last year of high school, and it was kind of my last opportunity to be here with him in the house, and I wanted to get that right.
So I want to ask you about a physical thing that happened to you, that you write about in the book. You were getting numbness and tingling,
right.
And was it your left hand?
My left hand and arm, yeah.
Yeah, and it was hard for you to play, and it turned out you had a disc problem in your neck.
Right.
And you had this, incredible surgery where they make an incision in your throat.
Yeah.
Push the vocal cords aside and basically rebuild your discs?
Correct. It was probably from thrashing my head around for 40 years or so. You know, it was just wear and tear. And I had a pinched nerve, and it was causing a lot of electricity down my arm. And I ignored it for about 4 or 5 years. It was just kind of getting worse and getting worse, but I was still able to get around on the guitar. And then during the middle of the Wrecking Ball tour, it simply became too much. I was having a lot of pain in my neck after the show, and my arm was going numb, and my fingers were going numb, and towards the end of the night, it could have got difficult to play. So I said, well, I guess I have to do something about it. So I found a doctor, and it's kind of an everyday operation, though you wouldn't want to get it wrong. You know, you can lose your voice or
lose your
complete feeling in your arms.
Putting your vocal cords aside?
That was the part that was a little anxiety creating. I said, well, what happens? He says, well, you know, we kind of slit your throat a little bit. Then we go in and we pull your vocal cords and we tie them off to one side. And then I get in there with the screwdriver and the little tools and some titanium. And Then we make a little basket in there. Then we take some bone off your hip and we stuff that into the basket and we kind of sew you back up. And before long, that all grows together and you're as good as new. Amazingly, that is exactly what happened. I'd spent about 3 months where I couldn't sing at all. So that was anxiety provoking. But after that, I went back out. I sang for 2 hours in my garage one day to see if I had a voice. It seemed to be okay. And we went to South Africa, and we just started playing and did the rest of the tour, and it was much improved. So it's remained much improved to this day.
Did physical pain was that part of the cause of the depression? Did it feed depression?
Physical pain?
Yeah.
Physical pain is my friend. I pursue it every night for 4 hours. That makes me feel good. I'm a good Catholic boy. So, no, I don't think so. No, it didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay. Do you feel like there's an extrovert and an introvert within you that sometimes compete?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose everyone has that. And in me, it's just a lot more noticeable. The extremes are a lot greater. I mean, if you see me performing, you're going, that guy's simply the most extroverted guy I've ever seen. What a show off, you know? But if you've seen me very often on a daily basis, and all the while growing up, I was very, very introverted, very introverted. So I have sort of the extremes of both of those characteristics.
As you mentioned in your book, you wanted to write songs that you wouldn't outgrow, that you could sing as an adult,
right,
that weren't just kids' songs and,
yeah,
you know, done, accomplished.
Yeah.
But when you sing some of your early songs now, as you still do, like Born to Run, does the song have a different meaning to you than it did when you first started, performing it?
We just had a series of concerts where the show was very interesting because we'd start out with my earliest material and we played about half a record off of our first record and then half or three quarters off of the second record. So it was going back to my earliest music and re-singing my earliest songs that I wrote when I was 22. And it was funny that they just fit perfectly well. You know, there was they sort of gather the years up as time passes, and you can revisit. The wonderful thing about my job is you can revisit your 22-year-old self or your 24-year-old self any particular night you want. The songs pick up some extra resonance, I hope, but they're there, and I can revisit that period of my life when I choose. So it's quite a nice experience, and the songs themselves do broaden out as time passes and take on subtly different meanings, take on a little more meaning, I find.
What's an example of a song that's taken on a different meaning or more meaning for you?
A lot of the ones that are people's favorites, you know, Born to Run, that expands every time we go out. It just seems to, more of your life fills in the story. And when we hit it every night, it's always a huge catharsis. It's fascinating to see the audience singing it back to me. It's quite wonderful, you know, to see people that intensely singing your song.
Bruce Springsteen, I can't thank you enough for inviting
us
into your studio and allowing us to do this interview.
Thank you
so much.
Very enjoyable. I appreciate it.
And I really love the book.
Thanks a lot.
Bruce Springsteen has a new memoir called Born to Run. The companion CD compilation is called Chapter and Verse. Our interview was recorded at his home studio in New Jersey. The other day when I was at an Amtrak station, a handsome dog on a leash came by and sniffed me. I passed the test. This was a working dog, trained to detect traces of explosives. Dogs are good at detecting explosives and other illegal substances, as well as pests like bedbugs and even certain cancers, because of their acute sense of smell. We're going to talk about what makes it possible for dogs to perceive scents that we can't. My guest, Alexandra Horowitz, is the author of a new book about dog's sense of smell called Being a Dog. She's best known for her bestseller, Inside of a Dog. She's also the founder of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College. Alexandra Horowitz, welcome to Fresh Air. Dogs have been used to hunt and track people, but now, because of their great sense of smell, they're being used in new ways, being relied on in ways that they've never been relied on before. Give us some examples.
The types of work that dogs now do as detection dogs is really stunning, and I don't think we've reached the capacity of what dogs are able to do. So dogs are, as we know, able to find explosives and drugs with some high acuity. They also are really good at finding us, finding missing people, whether dead or alive. But they're also used to detect goods that are brought into the country illegally, whether that's mango or bananas. They're also used to find animals whose population we're trying to count through detecting their scat. They can smell out illicit cell phones or computers if trained on the electronic components. So they're really used widely as detection dogs.
They're being used now to determine if certain tumors are cancerous?
Yeah, one of the most amazing things is that accidentally, researchers discovered that dogs could detect melanoma. The accident was that there were individual dogs who were persistently smelling something on their owners. When their owners finally went to a doctor and had it checked out, it turned out to be a melanoma. And so since that time, there's been a budding research program in training dogs to detect various cancers on the breath, in urine, in blood, and on the skin. And most of these programs report very high levels of success. Dogs are definitely able to detect whatever it is in the cell that makes it cancerous.
And of course, dogs are being used to detect explosives in train stations and airports.
You almost can't go to an airport anymore without seeing a dog. So it's becoming a familiar part of our life. And I think that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And bed bugs. Dogs are being used to detect bed bugs.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say we even had a bed bug detection dog come through our house and find nothing happily. But there are some dogs, especially beagles, who are trained to detect not just the bed bugs, but the trace of the bed bugs. In other words, the skin sloughed, the casing sloughed off, or the excreta of the bed bugs, and determine if you have a problem before you are bitten.
You write that explosive detection dogs can smell a trillionth of a gram of an explosive. I mean, that's such a minuscule amount. Can dogs smell like the remnant of an odor in such a microscopic size?
It does seem as though what they're detecting at that really low, low, low threshold is kind of almost the trace left behind by an object. You know, if we thought of putting a cup down that you've held on a table and picking it up, we would think that the cup is gone. But at some low level, the cup has left a trace of itself. And if you touch a surface and lift your hand, you have left a trace of yourself that has an odor. And the dogs can detect that.
So compare a dog's nose with our nose. Let's start with the fact that dogs' noses have stereoscopic capability. They can smell separately with each nostril.
Precisely. So, starting at the nostril, their nostrils are doing a little bit better work than ours are. They have all this musculature. We do as well with our nose, but theirs really allows them to get a different odor sample with each nostril, especially up close, which might be why they bring their noses close to things, one of the reasons. Then they have this amazing long snout, many dogs, which humidifies and filters the air and kind of rushes the air up to the back of the nose. We both have that same apparatus, but ours is less complex. And at the end of the nose, right sort of between the eyes, we both have a little patch of tissue called the olfactory epithelium, which has the receptor cells, the ones that really grab the odors and are going to send a signal to the brain. The dogs, it has just hundreds of millions more receptor cells than ours does. And that's probably partially responsible for their increased acuity.
Does that mean they can smell more categories of things as well as being more sensitive to particles of smell?
Precisely. I think they have more types of receptors, which allows them to smell more types of things that we might not discriminate at all. And probably that increased number translates to them having an increased sensitivity to the very existence of a substance.
So let's get back to the stereoscopic nostrils. Why do they have separate control of each nostril? How does that help them?
It makes sense to have the nostrils work independently just the same way as it makes sense to have our eyes get a different snapshot of the world so that we can create three-dimensional representation of what's out there. Binocular vision is the same as kind of stereo olfaction for a visual creature. That allows them to not only detect whether a smell is there, but where in space it might be. Is it more to my left? Is it more to my right? Is it in front of me? Is it behind me? Creating a picture of the world through smell.
The dog's exhale is different from ours, too, and adds to their ability to detect and identify smell. Can you describe the exhale? What happens there?
I love the fact that not only is the dog's sniff different than ours, but their exhale is different. I mean, it goes so deep, the differences between us. And in this case, researchers looking at the fluid dynamics of airflow found that dogs exhale through the side slits of their nose. So they inhale through the nostrils, but exhale through the side. And what that does is it allows the odors that they've inhaled to stay in there a little bit longer in the back of the nose. When you want to get a smell out of your nose, you can exhale it out. You can kind of push it out with an exhale. But dogs don't push all the smell out with a single exhale. It's like a circular breathing of smelling. And it also creates a little puff on the ground, a puff of air that might actually allow more odor molecules to come up toward their nose to be sniffed.
And they also have what you describe as a second nose under their nose.
Right. They have a vomeronasal organ, which is a small sac above the roof of the mouth under the nose, which allows them to detect other chemicals, especially things like pheromones and other hormones, which are water-soluble, which aren't volatile, don't evaporate in the air. And so that allows them, like other animals that have the vomeronasal organ, to detect hormones on other members of their species and even other species.
So now that you've told us a little bit about how dogs perceive the world through their sense of smell, let's talk about some of the things they can smell that we just can't. I mean, you've talked about detection dogs, but like you say, normal dogs, dogs who aren't working dogs, can smell, for instance, that it's afternoon, or they can smell that it's a new day. They can kind of tell time through their sense of smell. How do they do that?
I think this is one of the more intriguing things about imagining the olfactory world to a creature like a dog. Smells tell time. In other words, a strong odor is probably a newer odor or laid down more recently. A weaker odor is something that was left in the past. So in being able to detect the concentration of a smell, they're really seeing not only what it is, but how long ago it was left. So the past, for instance, when you walk outside your door, is underfoot. Who's walked by? What, you know, skin have they sloughed, leaving some evidence of their voyage? What animals have passed by? And the future, in a way, is smelled on a breeze from up ahead or around a corner. So I feel like time is rubber banded for dogs through smell. And it also allows them to detect things which we don't think are really visible yet, like dogs often are said to be able to detect an upcoming storm. One of the reasons this might be is that when a low pressure system moves in, the air above the ground kind of feels extra roomy and the earth loosens its grip on odors within it and they become volatile. They evaporate and go up in the air, and the dog can detect that. And you might see a change in their behavior when they notice this new smell.
But how can they smell that it's afternoon? What does afternoon smell like compared to morning?
Well, smells in a room change as the day goes on. Hot air rises, and it usually rises in currents along the walls and will rise to the ceiling and go kind of to the center of the room and drop. And so if we were able to visualize the movement of air through the day, what we're really visualizing is the movement of odor through the day. In the mid-afternoon, you might feel tangibly on your skin that, or see through the light in the window, that it's afternoon and the sun is halfway in the middle of the sky. The dog, I think, can smell that through the movement of that air through a room.
Does the size of a dog's nose determine how much a dog can detect through the sense of smell. I mean, for instance, some dogs have like really long snouts, and some dogs have basically like two little nostrils on their face.
Right. Well, to some extent, yes. But for the most part, the snout, it's this humidifying, warming chamber that hurries air to the part of the nose which really smells the odors. It doesn't matter truly if it's short or long. I mean, I think the dogs who are better smellers are usually long-nosed dogs. They both will have hundreds of millions of olfactory receptors, those receptors that catch odors in the back of their nose. But it is true that these short-nosed dogs are seen to be slightly less good smellers. And that's because we've basically bred these dogs to have slightly different shaped skulls, and they don't have all the equipment that a long-nosed dog will. So you rarely see pugs, for instance, acting as explosive detection dogs.
Right. Or never see them, I think, probably.
Maybe never. But they'd still be a lot better than we would.
If dogs are so good at detecting odors, why are they not repelled by their own smelliness when they get really filthy or they've rolled in something really foul?
It's not obvious that it is foul or smelly in that sense to a dog. In other words, I think when you try to imagine a world made of smells, smells become less binary than they are to us. For us, they're often really pleasant or really unpleasant. You know, I like freshly baked bread, and I really don't like garbage that sat on the summer on the street in New York City. But for dogs, those smells are just information. They're information about what's out there. And I don't think they levy the same judgment on smells. Just like when you walk into a room and you see a lot of visual information, we're not saying, oh, that's really a bad color, that's really a bad image, that's really a great one. We're just seeing it as a room.
But dogs eat things that they shouldn't eat because it's not good for them. In fact, it might be really toxic. And the offensive odor doesn't seem to necessarily put them off.
It's
because
true.
With
for
people,
instance,
you know, like a really foul odor, it's a warning. This is rotten. You really should not be eating it.
Yeah, and it can be a disorder if a dog is, for instance, eating their own feces. Most dogs are not doing that. They are avoiding things like that. And yet, they might eat another species' feces, and that's it's a little bit maladaptive, but it also indicates that the smell isn't any longer bad to them, that there's something else attractive in that smell. They roll in things like that. People have a few theories as to why they might. It might be to kind of camouflage their own scent, or maybe because it makes them more popular because they have this really stinky thing on them, among other dogs. Or maybe they just like the scent. It's hard for us to imagine that they like scents that we find offensive, but it seems to be the case.
We've all had the experience of going to visit the home of a friend where we haven't been before. The friend has a dog. The first thing they do when you arrive is greet you by smelling your crotch, which is embarrassing for everybody. So why do dogs do that?
It's a really smelly place. I mean, dogs are extremely good at honing in on the parts of us that happen to smell. And we secrete a lot of smells from a couple of parts of our body, the crotch, the armpits, the mouth. You know, one of the things you can do when you don't like that, which most people don't, is give them something else to smell. You know, they might be preoccupied with the smell of your ear, for instance. We have lots of glands that give off odors around our face, and that might suffice to be information about you. That's all. The dog is trying to get information. I love that we often feel like the dog is being impolite in that case, and many people will not unreasonably train their dogs not to do that. But I also see it as just the dog's way of discovering who you are, and we are our smell to them.
So you did this amazing experiment with what you call a peephole in a New York park. What was the poll, and what were you looking for?
Right. And we're still doing this experiment in New York City's Riverside Park, where we set up a pee post, essentially, which is just a place where a dog might leave an identifying bit of pee. And we set a camera up to capture instances of dogs visiting this. And what I'm trying to do is do some basic research about what dogs are doing when they mark. what we know from some research of feral dogs and free-ranging dogs is that dogs aren't doing what we mostly think they are doing when they mark, which is marking territory. Dogs don't have territorial marking pee like wolves do. They'll go around their home range and pee right around the perimeter so that any intruder will know that they're entering someone else's territory. What would be that home range for dogs? It's obvious that they no longer have that kind of perception of the world. They don't have home ranges. They do mark along shared paths, what researchers like to call runways. So if you encounter a lamppost or a fire hydrant or a tree trunk on your regular walk, and lots of other dogs too, chances are that dogs will mark all of these places. But what they're doing with this information, we're not exactly sure. So I was looking at all the behaviors around dogs sniffing of these mark spots of the pee post and what they do afterwards.
What did you learn?
Well, this far, it looks like there are a couple of interesting characteristics of the marking. First, they sniff a lot more than they mark. So it's not that every dog comes, notices that someone's been there before, and then has to leave their own mark. It's really not territorial or dominance related. Also, they often look up after they sniff. And it's really hard to see, I think, for most owners when their dog is looking somewhere, what might actually be happening, which is often that they're smelling somewhere. And if you look, their noses are working. You can see their noses working. They're probably smelling after the dog who has left that mark. My favorite observation is just that dogs don't come back to check again later. You know, they don't go to smell their own pee and see, has anybody covered this? Which I find fascinating.
Alexandra Horowitz, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my utter pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Alexandra Horowitz is the author of the new book, Being a Dog. She founded the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.